Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the August 14th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, I want to open the phones to you, our listeners. Well, it would seem to be inconceivable that after more than 10 years of waging war in Afghanistan and Iraq with nothing remotely resembling a victory to show from either battlefield, and our country trillions of dollars in debt, that Washington would be considering another potentially far more devastating war in the same region. But Washington, as we know, is represented by more than the president and his cabinet. And while it might seem that the Obama administration is hesitant about launching a war against Iran, the next target in Israel's crosshairs, some of the same powerful elements in our nation's capital that pushed us into war in Iraq on Israel's behalf in 2003 are engaged in doing the same with Iran with equal, if not greater, fervor. With Congress, for all intents and purposes, safely in AIPAC's pocket, the pro-Israel web of think tanks, namely the Council for Foreign Relations, the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institute, the Foreign Policy Initiative, the Foundation for Defensive Democracies, and the Saban Forum at the Brookings Institution are debating whether the most stringent sanctions ever imposed on a non-belligerent country will be enough to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, or is it better to not only take out Tehran's nuclear facilities through a massive military strike, but its government as well. It is rare to find a talking head on any of the network news programs or an NPR that is not connected to one or more of these institutions. If what I've just read to you seemed familiar, it should be no surprise. With the exception of the change of date, it was the introduction to my program of January 26th last year when I invited Interpress News Service's Middle East analyst Gareth Porter onto Takes on the World to provide us with an informed opinion on the conflict between Iran on one side and Israel, the Israel lobby, and the Israeli-occupied Congress on the other. With a newly elected president just installed in Iran, one thankfully without the ego, naivete, and theatrics of his predecessor, Iran's enemies in Israel and Washington have not hesitated a moment to escalate the pressure on Tehran to abandon its legitimate nuclear enrichment program or face the threat of a military attack by Israel or the United States. So to talk about the implications of that, I've once again invited Gareth Porter to be my guest, and we'll be getting into our discussion about Iran at about 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. To prepare you for that discussion, here's some news you probably haven't heard or read. First, by a vote of 420, the House passed a piece of legislation drafted by AIPAC that had 376 co-sponsors, which, if enacted into law and fully enforced, as the New York Times pointed out the day before the vote, could basically eradicate what's left of Iran's diminished oil exports by coercing its remaining customers to find other suppliers. Former AIPAC senior staffer M.J. Rosenberg, now one of its sharpest critics, noted that, quote, most of your favorite progressive members of Congress are co-sponsors of the AIPAC bill, meaning they knowingly put U.S. interests behind their fundraising desires. Here is a list, writes Rosenberg, read it and weep. No, read it and get angry, end quote. In case you're wondering, Jared Huffman's name is on that list. The legislation now moves to the Senate for consideration, where its passage by unanimous vote is a foregone conclusion. On August 3rd, before the House vote, 76 senators signed an AIPAC-drafted letter to President Obama, telling him what they want him to do regarding Iran, which didn't get reported in the U.S. media, but did get the attention of the Telegraph in Britain. In the very first paragraph, they tell the president that, quote, until we see a significant slowdown of Iran's nuclear activities, we believe our nation must toughen sanctions and reinforce the credibility of our option to use military force at the same time as we fully explore a diplomatic solution to our dispute with Iran, end quote. And they concluded, quote, we believe there are four strategic elements necessary to achieve resolution of this issue, an explicit and continuing message that we will not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapons capability, a sincere demonstration of openness to negotiations, the maintenance and toughening of sanctions, and a convincing threat of the use of force that Iran will believe. We must be prepared to act, and Iran must see that we are prepared. Mr. President, the letter went on. We share your conviction that Iran must not be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. We want you to know that you will have our support in doing all you can to resolve on an urgent basis this most pressing challenge to international security, end quote. The Senate, I should remind you, had already passed by a 99-0 vote a resolution calling for the U.S. to back Israel politically, economically, and militarily should it decide on its own to attack Iran. That neither Barbara Boxer nor Dianne Feinstein signed the AIPAC letter is no cause for celebration. AIPAC has a history of getting 76 senators, no more, no less, to sign a letter to a U.S. president going back to Gerald Ford, telling him what it wants the president to do or not do regarding Israel. And the first such letter to Obama arrived shortly after he took office, telling him to go easy on Netanyahu. A former AIPAC official, Steve Rosen, once bragged to New Yorker columnist Jeffrey Goldberg while the two were dining that if he wished, he could get 76 senators to sign the napkin on their table. And he wasn't exaggerating. Well, a second round of projected 9 months of peace talks between Israeli negotiators, Justice Minister Zippy Livni, and Netanyahu's personal attorney, Itzhak Malko, and Palestinian Authority negotiator, Saeb Erekat, began today in Jerusalem. As it was when the Palestinian Authority's Mahmoud Abbas negotiated the Palestinian surrender in Oslo in 1992, Erekat did not have a lawyer present to advise him. In reality, there is no war between Israelis and Palestinians, and there hasn't been for nearly a decade. This becomes evident when viewing videos of Israeli soldiers strolling through Palestinian villages and refugee camps without helmets, arresting Palestinians, even young children, for throwing stones, and demolishing people's homes. There's no resistance. The Palestinian Authority's militia works in collaboration with the Israeli military in suppressing Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation while providing no defense whatsoever when the Israelis choose to make their raids. The moderator for the so-called peace talks, Martin Indyk, is a British-born, Australian-educated, former AIPAC official, as well as U.S. ambassador to Israel, whose entire professional life has been spent working for Israel's benefit. So not only do the Israelis have a lawyer president, plus a collaborator on the opposite side of the table, but they also own the umpire. It would take a writer the caliber of Lewis Carroll or Jonathan Swift to put this ongoing farce, known as a quote-unquote peace process, in its proper perspective. Yet the mainstream media and some people who should know better are taking this lopsided affair seriously. To celebrate its latest chapter, the Jerusalem municipality yesterday approved the construction of 942 new Jewish homes in Arab East Jerusalem. The move followed an announcement Sunday of Israel's approval of 1,200 new homes in East Jerusalem and West Bank settlements that drew international criticism and condemnation from other Palestinians. On Monday, Secretary of State John Kerry said the new construction would not likely derail peace talks, admitting that the settlement plans were, quote, to some degree expected. According to Israel's online Ynet, however, he reiterated that, quote, the United States of America views all the settlements as illegitimate, end quote, a statement that he will, no doubt, be forced to retract. The announcement of Israel's new settlement building were doubtlessly designed to get the Palestinian Authority to either to abandon the talks or, if not, to subject it to further humiliation in Palestinian eyes. In a gesture supposedly configured to give the Palestinian Authority some excuse to sit down with the Israelis, Netanyahu agreed to the release of 26 of 104 Palestinian prisoners early this morning, all of whom had been confined in Israeli prisons for more than 20 years. This has stirred outrage among many Israelis who have attempted to block the prisoners' release, since many of them have been convicted of murdering Israelis in Israel's courts, where the life of a Jew has been judged to be worth infinitely more than the life of a Palestinian Arab. The release of the remaining 78 prisoners will depend on, quote, the progress of the talks, end quote, according to Netanyahu. In other words, they'll be held hostage to the Palestinian Authorities' willingness to make concessions to the Israeli negotiating team. It has been hardly discussed much on this side of the Atlantic, but it seems likely that a key factor in convincing Netanyahu to agree to begin the peace talks is his desire that Israel not be excluded from Horizon 2020, a multi-billion-dollar European Union initiative that begins next year, actually 139 days. As planned, it would bring many of those dollars or euros into the Israeli economy and firmly establish Israel's place economically, if not geographically, within the European community. According to its website, Horizon 2020 is the financial instrument implementing the Innovation Union, a Europe 2020 flagship initiative aimed at securing Europe's global competitiveness. Running from 2014 to 2020 with an 80 billion euro budget, the EU's new program for research and innovation is part of the drive to create new growth and jobs in Europe, end quote. And although the site doesn't mention it, jobs in Israel as well. As part of the agreement, according to Haaretz, the EU is expected to invest over 600,000 euros, approximately $800,000, in Israeli high-tech companies in the coming years. Apparently, to clear the deck of obstacles to raising Israel's status, the EU last month passed new guidelines that would prohibit it and its member states from any, quote, funding or financial investment and granting of stipends, scholarships, or prizes by EU agencies or foundations to Israeli groups connected directly or indirectly to the settlements, end quote. The EU's guidelines also state that in any agreement between Israel and the EU, there must be a clause to the effect that the settlements on the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights are not a part of the State of Israel. Israel annexed East Jerusalem in 1967 and the Syrian Golan Heights in 1981, but neither the U.S. nor the international community has recognized either action as having any legal basis. After initially responding defiantly to the announcement of the guidelines and placing restrictions on the movement of EU representatives in Israel and the West Bank, cooler heads in Tel Aviv prevailed, and Israel began efforts to undermine the new guidelines, saying at first that they would interfere with the peace talks and, quote, give Palestinians a reason to harden their positions, end quote. According to yesterday's Jerusalem Post, Netanyahu spoke with EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton about the guidelines on Friday night in a conversation described by one Israeli diplomat as, quote, unquote, difficult. Netanyahu reportedly told Ashton that Israel could not join the Horizon 2020 program on the basis of these guidelines. Ashton apparently made no commitments or promises about modifying them. Today, Irit Ben-Abba, Israel's Deputy Director General for Economic Affairs, was to head a delegation meeting with senior officials from the EU's Director General for Research and Innovation. According to the Jerusalem Post, he was expected to say that while Israel does not agree that funds should not be spent beyond what it refers to as the green line, it also understands that the EU can determine what it wants to do with its money. What Israel cannot accept, he was likely to say, are EU efforts to restrict Israeli companies from working beyond the green line. However, before the two sides meet for the next round of talks in September, according to the Jerusalem Post, Israel is hoping to come to understandings with the EU that will allow Israel to participate in the program. That's one of the reasons that Netanyahu will keep the phony peace talks from collapsing. You didn't read it. You didn't read or hear about it because everyone involved wanted to keep it secret. But last week, at the beginning of the August congressional recess, 37 House Democrats made their equivalent of the Hajj to Israel. They were led, as usual, by Maryland's Steny Hoyer, the House Whip and one of Israel's most loyal lackeys in Congress. It was Hoyer's 15th trip, but unlike as in the past, he's keeping closed mouth about it, being unwilling to even provide the names of those accompanying him to the media. This week, you also won't read or hear the Republican Majority Leader Eric Cantor is leading 26 GOP lawmakers on a similar expedition. The trips are designed to bring new members of Congress to Israel so, in my words, not theirs, they can familiarize themselves with who is actually calling the shots on U.S. Middle East policy. Besides meeting Netanyahu, President Shimon Peres and Israel's top military officials, they will tour the country and make the obligatory visits to Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum. The trips were paid for by the American Israel Education Foundation, a tax-exempt Dodge established by AIPAC as a 501c3 charity to get around the law prohibiting lobbying groups from paying for congressional travel. The Wiley Hoyer's office describes it as, quote, an independent, nonprofit, charitable organization, end quote. It, too, won't release the name of the Congress members making the trip. I guess only prospective donors to the next campaign will know. Finally, as reports come in from Egypt this morning providing details of the mass killing by the Egyptian army of unarmed Muslim Brotherhood supporters still protesting last month's coup against President Mohamed Morsi, it becomes ever more clear that what began as the Arab Spring has become a nightmare. In Syria, where al-Qaeda has co-opted what started as an internal opposition, the bloodshed continues. Libya has been ungovernable since the fall of Gaddafi for the same reason. In Tunisia, where it all began in 2010, there are signs of unrest. And in Iraq, where there was no Arab Spring, but a war by the U.S. which destroyed and divided the country, not a day goes by without a series of deadly bombings and assassinations, and the worst may be yet to come.